Understand how it's going down. It's your boy Westwood, kingpin of the car game, ride with the big dog, going in real legendary. And right now you're rocking hard to Media Talk from The Guardian, doing up real legendary. Heavy hit after heavy hit. We are going to bang in your face. Holla at your boy one.
My thoughts exactly, Mr. Westwood. Welcome to Media Talk. Coming up.
Alicia Pickup.
My heart is still beating for you. I can see you're so nervous. I thought you moved really well. That's the only thing I would say. Yeah. Well done.
Beaten in the ratings and battered by the critics. We discuss the Biebs Strictly debacle. Is it time for BBC One controller Jay Hunt to face the music? Also in the podcast, a political battle brews as Andrew Rawnsley quits politicshome.com. Plus, The Observer lives to fight another day, but the NUJ gears up for another battle.
Cuts of some sort are on the horizon, almost certainly job cuts, and I think we can predict that there will definitely be proposed budget cuts across the board, across the titles.
And
new formula L'Oreal Elnett.
Because I'm worth it.
Move over, Jennifer. Is ITV's chief executive in waiting, Tony Ball, really worth 30 million quid? I'm Stephen Brooke. This is Media Talk from The Guardian. Well, you can't keep a good panel show down. This week, one of the oldest panel shows, Question Time, has just turned 30, while Channel 5 has just launched one of the newest, Live from Studio 5. And to mark the occasion, Emily Bell, Guardian Director of Digital Content, you get first dibs. Who would you rather be, David Dimbleby or Ian Wright?
Oh, Ian Wright, right. He's a fantastic, he's a national treasure and asset.
And you're loving his new show, huh?
Love his new show.
That means you, Roy Greenslade, Professor of Journalism at City University, you can be either Melanie Phillips or Melinda Messenger.
That, again, is a no-brainer.
so to speak.
I'm going definitely here for, Messenger.
Well, that leaves me with a toss-up for Anne Widdecombe or Kate Walsh. We'll forget the Channel 5 team and Question Time. I suppose the most important question this week is, what were you watching on Saturday night?
Oh, I say, I've missed all that, haven't you? A standing ovation. Oh, I've missed all that. I really have. Fantastic. Thank you, our professional dancers. We have a new judge this year. Some newspapers did cover it a bit. But anyway, Alicia, may I wish you good luck, my darling.
Thank you.
Good luck. And welcome, a very big welcome to the show.
Thank you.
And it's nice to have you here,
Well, the world and his cha-cha partner are talking about Strictly Come Dancing. And while the Biebs' Saturday Night Dance-a-thon came second to The X Factor in their head-to-head last weekend, Strictly has grabbed all the headlines, but for all the wrong reasons. Alicia Dixon's judging debut prompted hundreds of complaints to the BBC. There have been angry radio phone-ins, thousands of column inches, even, would you believe it, a leader in The Guardian. Emily Bell, Jaina Bennett and Michael Lyons have had their say, so it's probably time that you jumped in. Everything this week, has it been a PR and a programming disaster?
Do you know what? For two things, I don't know and I do not care. I can tell you one thing about this, which is if they had two female judges on there from the start, they wouldn't be all this nonsense, which is not. I'm more interested in how many people were stuck to their sofas by Darren Brown on Friday night, and I'm not very interested in that. I just think it's preposterous. There are serious stories happening at the moment in the media, and this is just not...
Is this the biggest beat-up of all time?
Well, it's not. It's completely manufactured, isn't it, in a way? You know, the BBC knew exactly what they were doing. Arlene Phillips has actually got quite a good kind of post-Strictly career out of it.
She's got she's Alicia, headlining at the O2 or something,
Alicia
isn't she?
Dixon might not be a very good judge. Shock. That's not something to fill ailing newspapers with, is it?
Well, it certainly has been this week. Roy, I forced you to watch the show in preparation for the pod this week. What's your reaction to it?
My first ever and probably my last ever look at Strictly Come Dancing. Actually, I mean, what did they expect? She's a perfectly acceptable person, I would have thought. I mean, it's an entertainment show and she's quite entertaining. She is a bit challenged, but then so what? What do they expect? She's a little pop star and she has not perhaps got a fantastic range of views, expletives, adjectives, adverbs, probably doesn't know what they are, but it doesn't matter a hill of beans, does it? And what I did think, however, was that some of the comment was way, way, way over the top. And in fact, it's one of those self-fulfilling prophecies where people start to criticise. That encourages people to complain to the BBC, and then they respond.
Well, there have been complaints, haven't there, to the BBC, not just about Alicia, but about the scheduling clash. And now the latest thing has been this gagging order that's been placed on everyone from commenting about the whole thing, Emily.
Yes, apparently the BBC have told people that they're not allowed to. Is that right? They're not allowed to talk about it.
And they've been given the dancers given a crib sheet about what to say and what not to say.
Actually, I'll tell you what I found remarkable. I have, over the years, been a fantastic admirer of Bruce Forsyth, but I thought he was highly embarrassing.
Do you know what's the other issue?
Can I just say, if you were going to get someone who perhaps you felt was a little old for the show and replace them for this series, I think there's a candidate that would have had his hand up, or rather you would have put his hand up for him before Arlene Phillips. So, you know, Roy's absolutely right. That was the thing that struck me, was that, in fact, you know, quite self-indulgent, not edited enough, not bossed around, clearly doesn't have a producer who's kind of
standing up to him.
The practiced jokes are so poorly delivered. You know, I love the guy. I mean, I think he's done brilliantly, but really,
surely replacement by a much, much younger model like Sir Terry. He's now free.
Yeah. Good idea. Well, what do we think about Jay Hunt's role in all of this? Because apart from Alicia, there's the hugely long 2-hour-plus time slot that this show is getting, at least initially. Has the network been meddling too much? Who's to blame, Emily?
Well, you know, I think Jay Hunt is probably doing what most channel controllers do when they have a really successful brand, which is sort of making it work at its kind of maximum, to its max. There have been, again, in sort of the media dangerous dogs world, in other words, you know, politicians saying things about, Jeremy Hunt, I think, saying something about Strictly Come Dancing scheduling, because, of course, it grabs headlines, and it's scheduled against, you know, the X Factor.
This year it's a story. Lyons has been moved to comment.
Well, you know, this is again how Simon Cowell dominates journalists anyway, because it's his complaint which has been taken up. But, you know, has no one heard of time shifting? I mean, what's going on?
It's not an issue in our house. We PVR and we watch both.
Yeah, but you two are metropolitan media junkies.
Roy's rural.
Okay, Roy's rural. He's got two houses, though, so he's still part of the elite.
I'm sorry, Roy. We haven't invited you here to expose
I'm surprised now I'm here. I'm really glad to be among y'all.
No, but I mean, we know we're all on digital, and we're technologically advanced, and we've got all the products, etc., etc.
So have most people.
Yeah. Sky Plus.
It's ubiquitous, isn't it? If you really care about both shows, there will be a small number of households which will not be able to time shift, who would maybe like to see both. But they're spattered all over the schedule. You watch them anywhere, they're spattered all over the schedule throughout the week.
Here's a comment from the blog Sunny in BNC. Is that Barcelona? I don't know. Anyway, Strictly Come Dancing versus X Factor. Does this sound absolutely ridiculous to anyone else? A very sad day for British television. Is this really the best they can offer on a Saturday night? No wonder underage teenagers are turning to stabbing each other in drunken high
rages. Overage teenagers.
I think he should watch Darren Brown, which, as I say, is just it is the revival in spoon bending I have been waiting for.
It's Uri Geller, but with talent.
Exactly. It's showbiz Uri Geller. Why aren't we talking about Darren Brown?
Okay.
Shrug of the shoulders.
Next week, I think, Steve.
Yeah. Well, look, if you want to read more about Strictly or Darren Brown, you'll find plenty more waffle, some of it even written by me, at mediaguardian.co.uk. But let's give the final word on this to Alicia Dixon herself. Alicia, how do you think we did?
I love the chemistry, but I would say come out with a bit more personality. I know you feel you could have done better, but you've got great potential, and I'm looking forward to seeing you in the Latin tomorrow.
Sounds fair to me. Let's move on. Now, this news broke just after we finished recording last week's show. After months of speculation, Guardian News and Media confirmed that The Observer will not close down. However, GNM told staff at the world's oldest Sunday paper to expect further integration and more cost-cutting. But at a meeting called Stand Up for the Observer, the Journalists' Union warned that any attempt to introduce compulsory redundancies would lead to a strike ballot. I was at that meeting in central London, and so were this lot.
Michelle Stanistreet, Deputy General Secretary, National Union of Journalists. This is about getting the message out to people that this fight is far from over, that what we're very concerned about is that the viability of the Observer as a Sunday newspaper is enshrined for the future, so that this is a newspaper that continues to have a vibrant future as well as a very interesting and illustrious past. Because unless it's resourced properly, unless there are the committed team of journalists, unless that kind of quality is preserved, then we won't have a viable Observer newspaper.
My name's Alexander Walters, and I'm studying the newspaper journalism masters at City.
And you felt motivated to speak out today, Alexander. Why was that?
I did, because I felt that it's important that people who are going into journalism from a graduate background, from a young age, or from any background, anybody who's moving into the career for the first time, to take heart at a time when it's incredibly difficult. The industry is in a very poor state, admittedly, but to show that there are people who are young, intelligent, and passionate about newsprint media that want to go on and make something of it, and also to contribute to the rich history that we have already seen in newspapers like The Observer, and to speak out for their continued existence, I suppose.
I think almost certainly cuts of some sort are on the horizon, almost certainly job cuts, and I think we can predict that there will definitely be proposed budget cuts across the board, across the titles. The chapel is anticipating those, and as a newly merged joint chapel is gearing itself up to fight those cuts, because without adequate staffing, without adequate resources, neither The Guardian nor The Observer will continue as the kind of quality products that they are now.
Dominic Ponsford, editor of Press Gazette. If there was a website that 400,000 people a week paid £2 to look at and spent an hour on a Sunday browsing, it would be the most successful news website in the world. Let's do a bit of reality check and say, actually, we've got something really great here. Let's kind of protect it and cherish it.
If the company tries to insist on compulsory redundancies, as you heard tonight from the Chapel Joint FOC, that will almost certainly trigger a ballot, an automatic ballot for industrial action.
Well, my name is Francis Ween, and I've written columns for The Observer and The Guardian over many years. I would like to see it flourish, and I would like to see it not made into the sort of the whipping boy or the scapegoat for all the financial problems at GMG and GNM. Killing The Observer is not going to solve any of the financial problems at all. It would just be very bad for The Guardian's reputation and very bad for the plurality and pluralism of the newspaper market.
You're right, I worked for many years for Richard Desmond, so I'm used to successive culls and endless redundancy rounds, and I know how damaging, how disheartening to the journalists who work there, and ultimately what an impact it has on the quality of a newspaper, that kind of environment. And it's not one you would expect from a newspaper group that prides itself on its liberal approach, that prides itself on its commitment to quality journalism. I expect that from Richard Desmond. I didn't expect that from Guardian Media Group.
Well, Roy Greenslade, you're our newspaper man this week. You've been writing a lot about the crisis in journalism. Against that background, the fact that The Observer's been saved can only be regarded as a victory for liberal journalism.
Well, safe from what? Safe from rumours. I think if I want to be critical of the Guardian Media Group, it was not squashing the rumour straight away when it first happened. I think that was a tactical error. So a lot of people have got up ahead of steam to call meetings like that, which were entirely unnecessary. The Observer isn't needing to be saved because, as the group have now said, it is going to be maintained. But if we move on to the other aspect, which is that there will have to be cuts, there is not a newspaper in the Western world that has not needed to cut staff. Some of those cuts are due to the fact that they need to save money, but a lot of them are also due to the fact that we are now producing newspapers in a different way and can do it more efficiently and need fewer people. And the idea that The Guardian and Observer can stand out against the rest of the world, especially having announced figures in which they lost money, is, I'm afraid, absurd innocence and naivety on the part of many of those people who are interviewed, who I previously thought were rather brighter than that.
Well, Emily Bell, you're a former business editor of The Observer, and you attended the meeting on Monday night. It had been billed as this big Save the Observer meeting, but after the announcement by GMN, it kind of changed into something slightly different, didn't it? There were various readings and quite an interesting Q&A at the end of it.
Yes, I mean, it was a celebration, if you like, of the illustrious, I think somebody sort of called it the illustrious past of The Observer. And then there was a Q&A at the end. I mean, I have to say the other thing, I'm also a member of the GNM management board. So, you know, all of our statements have been made public and published on our website and written about extensively. So I can't really add much to that. I mean, what I did want to say, though, which is sort of perhaps kind of to amplify something that Roy just said, which is, I think, what I was slightly sort of disappointed about in the debate at the end was how somebody said we don't want the Observer to become the whipping boy, you know, etc. The sort of the pointing at different bits of the news business, saying that one's to blame, that one's to blame, that one's to blame. And I have to say this wasn't actually generally from sort of any of the GNM staff, but certainly kind of in the room, there seems to be an external perception that the internet and investment in web journalism is to blame for the current problems, not just at GNM, but actually throughout the news industry.
Because this actually spilled out into a blog that you wrote on Greenslade this week, Roy, where Emily Bell, you actually went on and commented, and Alan Rusbridger did as well. Because, yeah, people have been saying that, well, effectively, they've been blaming GNM's investment in digital, but you refuted that, didn't you?
Well, I mean, I think Alan was the person who restated the figures, and actually our investment in digital has been, you know, by any stretch of the imagination, relatively low. You know, it's,
I think it said that it was 20 million,
yes,
overall,
that's right,
since 2002.
Since 2002, and actually,
and
you know, within those, well, that is if you like, entire operational investment in what we spend on the web. And actually, operationally, since 2005, maybe not in 2009, but or 2010 rather, but it's either been at break-even or profitable level. This is where you have, as I say, I'm not going to make it specific to GNM, because I think it is a general kind of debating point in every newspaper group at the moment, which is, why hasn't digital worked, ... Now, you know, we're going to be probably over 30 million unique users on the website this month. Digital advertising revenue is rebounding a bit, actually, in September, certainly at a faster rate than print. There is no doubt that the fixed costs that most publishing companies have around print and print journalism are too high. And as Roy says, that there are no exceptions to that anywhere in the Western world at the moment. But if you're going to have a market for your journalism in the future, any kind of market, even a market out of which you can't really make very much money, it will have to have an electronic delivery mechanism, because it is what the audience wants.
Roy, you seem to be nodding. Are you in total agreement on that point?
Yes. I mean, I will be accused, of course, of just cozying up to my employer. But I look at this rationally, and I've looked at it across all the groups, and the same thing strikes one. I famously, or infamously, resigned from the National Union of Journalists a couple of years ago because I could see this coming, and that is that the union doesn't wish to understand that we need a shakeout. Now, of course, the union exists to save jobs.
Exactly.
But what I'm interested in is not saving jobs. I'm interested in saving journalism. And I think that we are confusing, and we've got used to this idea that journalism is tied absolutely to the concept of a newsprint newspaper or a traditional broadcaster, that they can't exist without each other, that they are linked totally by profit. I wish to separate that and see that there's an activity called journalism which we need to think about developing new forms and so on, collaborative journalism, participatory journalism, whatever you want to call it. And we have to let go. And I knew the union wouldn't be prepared to do this, and I understand why. I mean, that's their position. But I think we have to lose that link. And if that means that we have to say there are going to be fewer jobs, full-time, professional, highly paid jobs.
Which it does mean, doesn't it?
Which it does mean. You know, it's an uncomfortable thing to get to grips with, just as it was when I wrote once suggesting that we needed fewer subs. You know, I mean, it's awful. This is, look, let's face it, this is a digital revolution, not an evolution. People want it to evolve smoothly from one to the other. A revolution, by its very nature, I use that good Chinese word, fan shen, it means turn over, change amazingly. That's what a revolution means. And we are in the foothills of a revolution which is painful to the people who will need to be sacrificed and those who believe otherwise. Now, you know, save the Observer. What are you saving? History? Like my student at City University was quoting that, saving history. No, history exists. I want to save journalism, the best bits of journalism that we have now, the virtues that we have now, and take it on to another stage. Am I making this clear?
Okay, let's leave it there and stop fouling in our own nest, for a while at least, and look at some of the other media headlines this week. Roy, we'll start with you. You've written a blog about a privacy, not even a ruling really, because it was voluntary. This was the England football manager Fabio Capello's privacy action against the News of the World and the Daily Mail. And they voluntarily actually apologised and donated large monies to charity because they printed photographs of him whilst he was on holidays in Italy, but on a public beach. What was wrong with that?
Yeah, we've come a long way, haven't we? I remember back in 2000 that Anna Ford, the presenter, was it was decided by the Press Complaints Commission at the time that because she was on a public beach, that she had no right to privacy. But I think the Human Rights Act has made a huge difference here, and people taking privacy actions and the PCC, it would be unfair to say they've caught up, but they've appreciated the difference, which is that if you are obviously seeking privacy, even if you're in a public place, it is only fair that that privacy should be recognised.
Well, it seemed that in this particular case, the reason why the papers were in such hot water was that Capello, through the PCC, had the previous week sent warning messages to newspapers saying, I'm on holidays, don't bother me. And in fact, the FA did that before he was appointed and made particular reference to Capello's wife, who was in these photographs. And they realised they had no defence by showing photographs of her.
That's right. I mean, she is a private person. She immediately made that clear when he was appointed 18 months ago. But it also shows, doesn't it, the Football Association have been thinking about things. They've had a string of managers who have been
hit
attacked.
The headlines in a major way.
In a bad way, particularly Sven-Göran Eriksson, who had a much more, exciting private life.
Well, the new News Statesman has hit the streets. They've had another revamp, redesign, and editor Jason Cowley says that he doesn't want the left-wing publication to be such a ranter anymore. He wants it to be more nuanced. Do we think that's a good idea with a approaching election that's probably going to get the Tories into power?
Well, I think, again, probably the audience will decide whether or not a more nuanced approach is a good one. I mean, it's a very sort of glossy and thick beast, the new News Statesman. I was saying it looks a little bit like a slightly tabloidy Economist with bylines in it. It's that sort of paper quality, that sort of idea of kind of full-length page, you know, articles and lots of columns in it. I mean, it'll be interesting time for the Staggers, really, because, first of all, it's in a format, you know, the weekly news magazine, which is internationally challenged at the moment. I think apart from The Economist, everyone's having an absolutely awful time. Newsweek, etc., you know, Time magazine.
They're all shut their Australian edition.
Yeah, and now I'm not comparing the News Statesman with Time magazine, but, yeah, as a durable format, there's got to be a question mark over it. But political magazines actually do rather well in opposition. I mean, it's sort of interesting that, you know, The Spectator, obviously, notwithstanding its recent sort of sudden change of editors, etc., you know, actually had a rather sparky run since 1997.
Because I think people want, whinging about the government, they want an outlet to do that.
They want oppositional dialogue, and actually you don't get a lot of that when you've got a large majority government.
Roy Greenslade?
Well, glossy. I noted John Pilger wasn't there.
He's there next week.
Is he?
I mean, he's the heart and soul of the righteous New Statesman, isn't he? And I think you really need him.
And I'm going to miss Kevin Maguire because he wrote a chatty column. Nuanced, I don't know. My own thought is that this is not as good and interesting as The Spectator. This week it was a fantastic article by somebody I've not previously got on terribly well with, Andrew Gilligan. And there's always at least one or two things in The Spectator that really catch the eye. I get
and
both
teach
magazines.
You something you didn't know.
That's right. And I get both magazines each week. And for me, to use that word again, The Spectator is definitely more nuanced than The New Statesman.
Emily Bell, Tony Ball is still not ITV chief executive last time I checked the website.
Dear, oh dear.
Apparently now he wants a £30 million salary. Is he worth it?
Well, it depends what he does. Is he worth it? If he doubles ITV's share price, I'd say pay him some more. I mean, it's like, you know, it's sort of fantasy. It's a ridiculous money.
But the money actually is apparently tied to performance targets,
exactly,
isn't it?
Exactly. So as I say, you know, they're not going to pay him £30 million until there are sort of fairly spectacular performance targets. And if he hits them, he probably, you know, a small percentage of that money, you know, give it to the chief executive, give it to the banks, whatever. You know, it's sort of that's how business works. It is unfortunate that they've gone into this process and it's become public and they haven't got their man in through the door, and the amount of money on the table is being discussed. And if he says no now, what then?
Plan B.
Or
what
C.
Yeah.
Or Plan X. Or
it
X.
Has been a rather long and public courtship, hasn't
it? It never happens easily at ITV,
but
does it?
I was going to say, it just adds to the perception that it is actually, you know, in some sort of corporate crisis. And again, there can't be a member of the... the shareholders, I'm sure, are very keen to have Tony Ball in the seat. I don't think there's a member of the board that's absolutely kind of, you know, nailing up the bunting as we're recording. So, you know, you can't help but feel that... This is, I mean, I know we overuse the phrase last throw of the dice, but actually somebody's got to put ITV out of its misery.
Why not Simon Cowell?
Yes, make Simon Cowell chief executive and be done with it. Is he worth the money? I mean, God, you know, he's got them over a barrel though now, because as I say, they really basically have to get him through the door.
Yeah.
So the negotiation has, you know, the negotiation has kind of, it's over.
Time to talk politics. And as conference season gets into full swing, there's trouble at one of the most influential political websites. Andrew Rawnsley, the Observer star columnist, this week resigned as editor-in-chief of politicshome.com after the website was sold to Lord Ashcroft, the deputy chairman of the Conservative Party. Rawnsley said that the website policy of non-partisanship was fatally compromised under its new owner, who also owns a stake in Ian Dale's Total Politics magazine and the Conservative Home website. This is all very unwebby, isn't it, Emily?
Well, it sort of has kind of echoes of, you know, as I say, it's difficult to know what Lord Ashcroft's game
plan
is here. Because is it to close down dissent ahead of the next election? So David Cameron stands a better chance. I mean, David Cameron, it has to be said, could hardly have a better chance, and I don't think the ownership of a couple of political websites will make a deal of difference. Or is Lord Ashcroft, who, you know, has been sort of challenged in the past by his role in party funding and as chairman, etc., with his sort of existence in Belize, is he actually going to emerge as the sort of Ariane Huffington of the right, which is, you know, if you want to make a play to be an influential media owner, you probably wouldn't start with a newspaper.
So Roy Greenslade, does this purchase by Lord Ashcroft increase his power and influence?
I don't think it matters a hill of beans, actually.
You're so contrary sometimes.
I really don't. I mean, I just think it's completely irrelevant who owns a particular website. I don't agree with Emily. There's, you know, he's not going to be an Ariana, I just don't think that it matters in the least.
Well, on this particular point, and here is something that was in the New Statesman and interesting, Mehdi Hassan has written a column where he talks about the echo chamber effect in blogging, and his theory is that Ashcroft buying up all these blogs will give the Tories enough chatter, if you like, in cyberspace to mean that their contentious attacks get repeated and repeated and can assume the status of becoming accepted fact.
You know, people are web savvy now. Yeah, they see that.
But also, I think that's going to happen anyway. You know, in the run-up to an election where you're going to have a change of administration, where actually a lot of political discourse, you know, particularly from the inside baseball crew, is now entirely on the web. It's going to happen anyway, which I am quite intrigued about why he's actually done it and what he thinks, and whether, as I say, this is a sort of an almost kind of, you know, new Maxwellian approach to kind of linking, you know, party funding and media dissemination. I mean, I'm a great fan actually of Politics Home. I think it's a real shame that Andrew Rawnsley has resigned, because I don't know how good it's going to be. And actually, Conservative Home as well. It's a terrific site. But they don't. I mean, their page impressions, it says here in the Times, were like 1 million a month each, which is actually, it has to be said, you know, really quite low. So I don't know how much he paid, or I'd love to know how much he paid.
But this is kind of the same argument though about the New Statesman and the Spectator. It's low page impressions, low circulation, but it's, you know, it's the right people.
The opinion formers. Yeah. But I, you know, I think this is the cyber equivalent of Tony Blair's wooing of Murdoch, in that he didn't need to, because he was going to win the election anyway. Mm. Cameron doesn't need this. Ashcroft and Cameron stroke don't need this, because they're going to win the election anyway. Mm. I mean, it's like really overkill. There is already a tide against Gordon Brown of such momentous proportions that you can't imagine him winning the election.
I do love the idea, though, of tycoons buying up websites. I don't know why. It just makes me slightly happy.
Fingers crossed, Emily. All right, team, your incarceration in the studio almost done, but before you're set free, let's find out what you've learnt this week. Roy Greenslade, do you want to start us off?
I have learnt to enjoy even more the battle between Dennis O'Brien and Tony O'Reilly. There was a fantastic... there's a great programme on RTE, Tuesdays and Thursdays in Ireland, called Prime Time. And they did an item on the Clash of the Titans, as it was called this week, which was absolutely wonderful. These two very rich men, who both made it in the media, are fighting over this company, which has now got the lowest share price. It's lost 90% of its value in less than 2 years. And at stake is the future of the British newspaper, The Independent. There's Dennis O'Brien, who wants to sell it at any cost, and Gavin and Tony O'Reilly, who wish to save it at any cost. They claim that it is the editorial hub of their newspaper empire. And then you think to yourself, just a minute, what empire is it? 200 titles, sounds great, but they own a rump of newspapers in Australia, a couple of papers in New Zealand, some very unprofitable papers in South Africa. Not, you know, they do make a profit, but the rand transferred here doesn't mean very much. And they're even struggling in their home base in Ireland. And you think, why is everyone fighting over this company?
Emily Bell, what have you learned this week?
I've learned something much shorter, which is that a packet of biscuits stands more chance of sticking me to my sofa than Derren Brown.
Well, I've learned this week that there are a few changes coming up at The Spectator. Sarah Standing's column has been dumped, and it looks like there's going to be a return of a very old favourite column, Portrait of the Week. So that's good
news. Can we make sure next week that we discuss things with even smaller circulations and user bases?
Yeah.
If we could find, you know, kind of probably Angling Today, actually, has probably got a larger readership.
Well, you know, I was looking around. Cage and Avery Birds has 16,000.
Meet
the
Trades
New
Journal.
Statesman has 23,000. Horse and Hound has 60,000.
Very
the
quick.
Lady, can't we do Rachel Johnson taking over the
yeah,
lady? That's
yeah,
got
yeah.
about, you know,
yeah.
four people reading
yeah.
it.
Yeah, and
all of them.
20,000, I think. Yeah, but they're ladies. Marvellous. Well, look for links on all our stories. Head to guardian.co.uk/mediatalk. You can post a comment there on the blog or find us on Facebook. Matt Wells is back in the saddle next week. So for now, let's say thank you to Emily Bell and Roy Greenslade. Media Talk is produced by Ben Green, and I've been Stephen Brooke.